Thomas Miller joins me to discuss Oktoberfest and Helles beer styles. This is Beersmith Podcast number 229.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 229, and it's early January 2021. Thomas Miller joins me this week to discuss Oktoberfest and Helles beer styles. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They offer access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. For more information, again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith 3 software a try. If you've not downloaded the new 3.1 update, grab it now as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download your free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome Thomas Miller. Thomas has been part of the brewing industry since 1990. He has been widely published across a variety of print and internet media, serving America's craft beer scene, including Brewpub and Brew Your Own magazine. He published his first novel, An Oktoberfest Death, in 2020. It's great to have you. Thomas, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks. How are you today?
A first-time guest on the show, and we're happy to have you.
Well, I'm very happy to be here, Brad. Thank you very much.
So you've actually been working in writing about brewing for some time, and then I think you mentioned you took a little hiatus when we were discussing before the show.
Yep. This is, when it comes to talking about my history, I hate to like take it way back in time, I suppose, but my love for beer started in high school. And that might not sound like such a great thing, knowing that we have a 21-year age drinking requirement. But I studied German, and I had an opportunity as a high school student to spend time in the summer between my sophomore and junior year in central Germany. And it was during that time in central Germany that I kind of, for lack of a better description, learned about the beauty of beer firsthand. And while I enjoyed the opportunity to drink the beer, I also learned about presentation and flavor. And it was really that presentation and the flavor that when I came home to the United States, carried over into this love affair, this desire to learn and become more involved with beer. I was that one kid in high school that had a locker that didn't have like pictures of attractive women or perhaps sports stars or whatever the case might be. I had cutouts from German magazines of like a Pilsner style beer with the beautiful head like sticking up over the top of the glass, because I was enthralled by what German beer was all about, and was really committed to the idea that my study of German and of German culture was going to carry over into learning more about beer. As I graduated from high school, I went on to study German longer. I actually went into college with an intention of studying German and spending additional time overseas. And as a sophomore student at a college in Ohio, I had the opportunity to spend a year in Salzburg, Austria. Wow. And in Salzburg, one can say that I definitely had a lot of opportunity to become familiarized with Austrian style beers, Hefeweizen styles. And in fact, that was the first time that I ever got to travel to Munich to visit the Oktoberfest. Very cool. Homebrewing started really in 1990. Mm-hmm. That was when I first got involved. After I got back from my time in Salzburg, the following year, I took a trip to work in Glacier National Park. And while traveling out west with a friend, we stopped in St. Louis. And at our stop in St. Louis, we visited the Anheuser-Busch Brewery. And to date, I had just been a consumer of beer. But at the Anheuser-Busch Brewery, suddenly I was like, oh my gosh, this is how you make this stuff. This is really cool. And I must have spent a lot of the summer kind of talking about how fascinated I was about the beer production process that this friend I traveled with was kind enough to get me a very simple book at the time. I don't even know what the title was, but a very simple book just about how to get started in home brewing. And, you know, from there, came back after that summer in Glacier and was just like fully enthralled with the homebrewing scene. Started reading different homebrewing books that were available at the time, like the Charlie Papazian, you know, Complete Joy of Homebrewing, everything that was out there. I got deeply engaged with homebrewing really in the mid 1990s.
And then you mentioned you wrote some articles then, and then eventually recently, you took a hiatus, and then I guess recently you transitioned into beer fiction. Is that right?
Yeah. The path to getting there though is to me what's sort of interesting, right? Because beer fiction came from all the different experiences that I was involved with. Mm-hmm. I had the opportunity to work in a brewery in Munich. I had the opportunity to be an assistant brewer at a place in Jackson, Wyoming, and worked at Snake River Brewing Company for a period of time as a brewer. But what I discovered in the process of all that, because I was as much of a student and a writer and interested in culture and history, I discovered that, you know, working the production side of a brewery was a little bit turning a hobby into a job, right? And a lot of people would say, do what you love, turn your hobby into a job. But what I kind of discovered for myself was that turning a hobby like homebrewing that I enjoyed so much into a full-time job was a journey that was taking away some of the pleasure that I found in just, you know, concocting my own recipes, working on the craft of making beer at home, and you know, becoming an expert sort of in that regard. And so I started to find ways to write, and ultimately took some of the writing skills that I developed as a student and got involved in writing for the beer industry, right? So things from about 1995 to about 2005 or 2006, where I wrote for a lot of very interesting publications. I mentioned to you before we started the conversation that I was frequently wrote for Brew Your Own magazine, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners are very familiar with Brew Your Own magazine.
Yep.
You know, it's just such a great publication for homebrewers and so filled with information. And I was certainly proud looking back on it and proud even to this day. To have been a regular contributor, I wrote a lot of the tips from the pros columns that you would find both in the Brew Your Own magazine now as well as in the Winemaker magazine. I wrote for an industry magazine for the brewing industry back in the day called Brew Pub. I think it folded in something like 1998, maybe 1999, but that was specific to the brew pub industry back in the late 1990s. And so, you know, like all that different writing ultimately brought me over to this, had to take time off. I needed to focus on career and family, kids, all that kind of thing. So I took off a bunch of years and used that opportunity, not just to focus on all the things I just mentioned, but to think really about what would be an interesting sort of future endeavor around my love for beer and the things that I had sort of done previously in my life. And travel, culture, history, and beer are all, without a doubt, woven together in my experience in such a fashion that the fiction that I am now developing with the first novel now being An Oktoberfest Death is intended to bring all of that sort of story together, a part of my life, a part of my experience, part of my perspective, but then also share that and the changes and the excitement around the beer world, and especially now the American craft beer scene will be what will play out in subsequent novels in this series.
Well, I want to dive into the novel at the end, but before we do that, you mentioned today you wanted to talk about a couple beer styles, and I'm sure you're going to get into some of the history and the culture that goes around the beer styles as we discuss them. And then I'm hoping we can wrap that up at the end and talk a little more about your book. But let's start with the first one, which was Oktoberfest. You mentioned you went to the Oktoberfest in Munich. Obviously, mm-hmm. The Fest style is very, very popular, really worldwide. What's some of the history behind that particular beer style, and how has it evolved over the years?
Yeah, it's, I think it's important first to realize, to kind of contextually think for a second that the Oktoberfest itself is more than 200 years old. Like, it's easy to kind of sit here today and just here we are in our present, 2021. We just had the, first time in recent history where the Oktoberfest itself in Munich was canceled. And with all the impacts of COVID, to just forget a little bit the long history of the Oktoberfest. And it truly dates back to the early 1800s. In fact, 1810 was the genesis, so to speak, of the Munich Oktoberfest. And it wasn't a beer festival as we understand it today. Instead, it was a marriage ceremony. There was the intended marriage of Crown Prince Ludwig to Princess Teresa, and it was scheduled to occur in mid-October. I think it was October 12th. And the actual event itself was going to be a horse race. This was a situation where a few of the Bavarian officers petitioned or convinced the king of Bavaria at the time, King Maximilian, to cap off the wedding ceremony with a horse race mm-hmm. at a meadow outside of the gates of Munich, right? It's like we see Munich as it is today as a major city, but Munich, back in the early 1800s was completely different than we can even imagine it now. And so kind of convinced the king to put on this horse race, and it was wildly successful, right? And so with all that success, of course, came the desire to repeat it and turn it into, an annualized event. And so, in years that followed, things would occur with like agricultural wares being brought to the event, from around all of Bavaria, and perhaps other, like trapeze artists or things like that were brought to the Oktoberfest in order to expand the event. But what ended up occurring though is that in the field outside of the old Munich, this meadow is called Theresienwiese, or in today's words, they just call it the Wiesen, but the Theresa's meadow is where they originally ran those horse races. And that meadow, the Wiesen, has been since turned into the place where the Oktoberfest is enjoyed on an annual basis. And only a few times in history, really, through wars and COVID in this instance, has the Oktoberfest ever been canceled. So for the most part, it has gone on annually since 1810. Hmm. I think it's important to also, when we talk about just the time, when you go back in time to 1810, to think a little bit about how different the Oktoberfest would have been or would have felt for people that visited the Oktoberfest then than what we know today, right? We fly across the ocean if flights were available to us, traveling by train or by car if we were from outside of Munich. But for those, in the early stages, in the early, say first 100 years or so of the Oktoberfest, they traveled in by foot, maybe by wagon or horse. But for the most part, getting to Munich and getting to the Oktoberfest, unless maybe you lived within the city proper, was a challenge, right? It was part of physically challenging to get there. And so, as part of that being challenging, the idea within Oktoberfest literature, and one of the first things that I ever sort of studied and actually wrote about and published about, was the changing concept of thirst, Durst in German, as it plays through in literature specific to the Oktoberfest. One of the first, actually the very first thing that I ever published was in a Bavarian literary magazine called Literatur in Bayern. And it was about the beer at the Oktoberfest and how the meaning behind the word thirst had changed in Oktoberfest literature over the last, you know, like roughly 180 years or so, whenever it was that I had actually written that article. So there's like a lot of history conceptually behind the event that then ties into the beer, right? So, so you know, we really want to think about all those different contexts when we talk about the style and the way that the style has changed.
Well, can you talk about the specific sure. style that like you said has evolved over time?
Yeah, absolutely. The original style maybe a little bit hard to pinpoint when you go back to 1810, right? Because some of the production methods and the production capabilities in the early 1800s were nothing like what come up as industrialization occurred throughout Europe and throughout the greater West. But the idea in Germany of calling beer flüssiges Brot or liquid bread is a concept that speaks to the German mindset of beer being a staple food. And one of the reasons that beer is considered a staple food in Germany is because of the long tradition and also the type of beer that was brewed historically within Germany, right? Like it dates back over a long timeline whereby the beer used to be typically a darker beer, a heavier beer, a more robust style of beer. And the original style of the Oktoberfest, like I said, can't necessarily be pinpointed at the time of 1810, but we can kind of like, I think, get a pretty good idea of what the beer was like based upon the tendencies at the time to make these darker, more robust beers. But but by the 1850s, there began to be a greater understanding, a greater perception of how yeast plays a role in the fermentation process. And so in major brewing centers throughout Europe, particularly in Vienna and in Munich, breweries were starting to try to figure out how to overcome the negative implications from a flavor perspective, the negative implications of what warm summer weather would do to the beers that they were producing. And so one of the tricks that the smart brewers at the time figured out was that by brewing in the cooler seasons, and specifically brewing in March, and then utilizing caves and cool areas in order to keep the beer safe during the warmer months, resulted in a more flavorful, more delicious, predictable beer come the fall. Mm-hmm. And so in German, March is März. And so Märzen means March beer, basically. And so beers that were produced in March became Märzen, and then became beers that were going to be, you know, rolled out more towards the fall. There's some, evidence based on research and whatnot that Spaten Brewery in Munich, one of the remaining larger breweries today, the Spaten was the first Munich brewery to introduce a version of the modern Märzen beer, like roughly in the early 1840s, I believe is when they think that was originally introduced. And then several decades later, in early 1870s, part of the Spaten brewery lineage, so not Spaten itself, but one of the breweries within the what ultimately became Spaten Brewery through a relative of the Spaten owner at the time, they introduced the very first, what was considered the first Oktoberfest Märzen in about early 1870s. And that really became the style that ruled the Oktoberfest for the next 100 years. It tends to be more of a amber to copper red colored beer. Mm-hmm. It's not pale. We'll talk about fest beer in a second, but a traditional Märzen tends to be more of a darker colored beer. Has a nice, rich, bready, aromatic component to it. Like kind of a creamy, smooth mouthfeel with like a hint of carbonation. a proper like moderate carbonation without being overly spritzy on the tongue. And you know, if you go back to that concept that I mentioned of flüssiges Brot, liquid bread, that's I think a good like flavor concept to throw at a traditional Märzen, right? Like a toasty bread like characteristic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about how you can brew one of these beers. What starting with the grain bill, can you go ahead and walk us through what a typical recipe might look like and what some of the processes involved are?
Sure. So, you know, a fest beer and a Märzen are two distinctly different types of beers, right? A Märzen is going to be, like I said, the darker colored style of a traditional Oktoberfest. The fest beer is the style of Oktoberfest that you find. If you visited the Oktoberfest today, that's really what you'd find being served in the tent. It's kind of like a Helles style beer on steroids.
It's a little lighter, if I recall, right?
Yeah, far lighter in color. It's going to be really talk about a Helles here, I think, in a moment. But it took over as the beer of choice at the Oktoberfest, really starting in about the 1970s. There's some history that indicates that maybe in the early to mid 1950s, Augustinerbräu introduced the Edelstoff. And the Edelstoff was sort of like the first move towards a stronger, light-colored beer that then became its, in a sense, a precursor for the Oktoberfest fest beer style that we know today. But when I like to make an Oktoberfest, though, what I try to do in my home brewing is really fall to the Märzen style for a variety of reasons. One, from a historical perspective, I find it to be interesting and enjoyable and maybe a little bit more challenging, but I like the robustness of the flavor and trying to pull in the various characteristics that I mentioned here just a moment ago. So what I tend to think towards is the fact that Vienna malt can really be used as the primary base malt when I'm brewing an Oktoberfest beer, and then supplement that with a smaller amount of Pilsner malt and then a portion of Munich malt in order to sort of round out that sort of breadier characteristic that I'm shooting for in the final style. My most recent version is I looked at the percentages of the malt bill just to kind of discuss that here today. What I specifically did was 57% Vienna malt, 29% Munich malt, and 14% I used the Bohemian, the floor malted Bohemian Pilsner. I've been experimenting with a floor malted Bohemian Pilsner in my different German style beers over the last year, and so that was kind of what I did as far as the overall grain bill. Again, shooting for that darker characteristic, but trying to get that kind of that liquid bready type of component to it without making a beer that was too heavy. I sort of shot towards like a 5-8% alcohol volume target is what I was shooting for with that. So I didn't want something that was going to like knock you out, but I wanted something that was appropriate to, you know, Oktoberfest Wiesn style strength. I think here in the States, we tend to want higher alcohol content beers, but at the actual Oktoberfest itself, if you find something over 6%, I'd be pretty surprised.
Yeah, it's interesting you're using so much Vienna malt too. I know it's probably a little bit more traditional to use Munich malt, right, as a base.
So Vienna malt actually has more of the diastatic power, has more of a conversion capability, and it as opposed to Munich malt, which so from my perspective, needs a little bit extra boost in order to get you over the top from a conversion perspective and get you the fermentable sugars that you need, right? And so Vienna malt plays a strong base. And if you remember some of the attributes of the history of how Märzen was part of like the Viennese as well as the Munich brewing history, trying to blend those concepts together to create an interesting overlap of the way that those malts can play together. Again, like basically replacing replacing Pilsner malt with a Vienna malt because of their ability to serve as a base malt itself, but give more of the bready characteristics that you would be searching for in the Munich malt.
And what kind of hop and mash schedule do you use? Do you have a preferred yeast style?
Yeah, I am. I think by default, because of the fact that I made the decision a few years ago to start growing Hallertauer hops on the side of my house, when it comes to making German style beers, I'm pretty much wedded to Hallertauer hops. But that doesn't mean that I always use the homegrown hops in my beer, because it's a little bit difficult, sometimes not impossible, to know precisely what sort of AAUs I'm going to get out of that hop. So I might tend, as I did in my Oktoberfest this year, to use a more of a pelletized hop and more of a predictable outcome with regards to that. So I use Hallertauer hops. I would no doubt I would always stand by using a German style noble hop for any Oktoberfest or any German style beer really that I was going to make. I wouldn't vary from that, just out of a sense of being a little bit of a purist in that regards. I'm sorry, what was your next question?
Well, it was a mash schedule, I guess. Do you do anything special in the mash, for example?
Yeah, so just thinking here for a second, how did I do my mash? I tend to mash in at a bit of a lower temperature and work my mash up. So through the system that I utilize, and actually I'm one of these electric brewer people here lately, testing out an electric brew system over the last year to see if I like the results. I tend to mash in close to like a 135 temperature. That's like my target temperature. And then utilize the system itself, the fact that it has an electric element, to slowly raise through these rests towards mash out at 170. So like I'll mash in and target a temperature about 135, trying my best to, you know, bring in the beta amylase to the start of the mash process. And then as I elevate the temperature, and then I have a recirculation pump that allows the temperature to just gradually elevate through the reheating, that I'm working through all of these different rests without having like a sudden shock by adding just a bunch of hot water.
Sure.
Or by doing some sort of a decoction. Right.
How high do you go? How high do you stop?
I'm sorry. How high
temperature? How high temperature do you stop? I mean, you're gonna ramp it up over time.
I'll let it rest at about at 135 for about 10 minutes, and I'll start moving it up to about 145 and let it rest there for 30 minutes. And then I'll ramp it up to about 156 or so, and then and let it rest there. Again, it's moving through all the different temperature gradations during the process, and then I'll mash out at 170. And the system with the recirculation, it works quite smoothly.
Yeah, no, that's great. What about your yeast? Do you have a preferred yeast, and how do you ferment out and finish the beer?
Yeah, the my feeling on the Oktoberfest is that, again, it needs to be a traditional Bavarian style yeast. What I did this particular year was the Imperial, the L13 Global, which I, my understanding, that's the Weihenstephan yeast. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I also thought was really important for the beer, I'm trying my best to avoid any sort of like off flavor, unexpected fruitiness because of temperature shock and the like, was A, most importantly, I'm sure your listeners all know this, get your temperature down immediately, right? You boil hard, you chill fast, right? So you got to get that down to pitching temperature as quickly as you can. The system that I'm using now as an immersion chiller, I'm not the hugest fan of that. But I do appreciate the fact that it's easier to clean that it does provide, again, through the electric system, I'm able to monitor the declining temperature pretty closely and get it to shut off where I need to. In this instance, I shut it off when I hit 55 degrees and then basically whirlpooled it really quickly within the the electric system, the mash tun system that has the all-in-one, basically, if you want to call it that. And let it rest for about 15 minutes to create a whirlpool, and then I transfer it over at 55 and actually use two packets of the that Imperial global yeast that I mentioned to help get fermentation started quickly and efficiently without the risk of putting stress on that yeast. But at the same time, I have one, I'm sure again many of your listeners have one of these repurposed chest freezers with an external thermostat. I got the fermenter into that freezer at a 48 degree temperature setting immediately so that while the yeast was ramping up, the temperature was going down. And so in the process of that, I got it set down to 48 degrees. So by the time really we were at, you know, full Kreuzen, we were talking about a temperature of about 48 degrees inside the vessel. And I think holding, you know, having that temperature and holding a cold temperature is of anything that you can do making a lager style Oktoberfest or a Helles, getting the temperature, the fermentation temperature right, that is the, if nothing else for homebrewers, that is the key to a good beer.
And a related style you wanted to discuss was Helles. And we probably can't go into quite as much detail because of time, but can you talk a little bit about Helles and how it came together?
Yeah. Well, I mentioned briefly the Fest beer as a style, because that's like similar to the Oktoberfest in terms of, you know, people like to drink the Oktoberfest. But the Helles itself, you know, if you look in the guidelines, the BJCP guidelines, what you find under the pale malty European lagers are the Hellesbock, the Fest beer, and the Helles, right? And so it's sort of in reverse order, the Helles being the lightest, so to speak, the weakest from an alcohol content of the different pale malty European lagers that you can get. If you go way back in time to the late 1800s, the Czech brewers, they were coming up with some pretty popular beers. The Czech, while you're going to hit this phone here. Sorry about that. The Czech brewers were coming up with Czech Pilsner styles, and those were proven to be very popular. And so Munich brewers, again, more traditionally, having been making darker beers, more robust beers, also realized or recognized that brewing's a business, right? They needed to compete against what was showing itself to be a very popular style. And so so they started developing this Helles, as it's called, right? So Hell in German basically means pale in English. And so a Helles beer is a pale lager. It's designed to be, you know, golden in color, yellow to golden in color.
Is it tied at all to the Oktoberfest, or is it a completely separate style?
It's a separate style. It's not really. It's really more from my perspective. It is a competitive tack, so to speak, of the German breweries around the time of the Czech Pilsner, in order to remain popular, competitive in that space during the time that the Czech Pilsner was gaining market.
Did it originate in Munich or somewhere else in Germany? I can't recall.
Yeah, it's the Munich Helles. Okay. Known for being really originating in the Munich area. Yep.
Well, tell us about brewing a Helles, starting with a grain bill again.
Well, so similar to what we talked about with the Oktoberfest, just to kind of like think a little bit about the percentages that I put into these beers, trying to find it here for 1 second. It's like what I try to do is test out different like potential recipes to see what I think is going to work out best. And so like what I've tried in brewing this beer is continuing to dabble in the idea of using this floor malted Bohemian Pilsner, and then also tying in Vienna malt to push into the Helles style, a little bit more grainy characteristic than perhaps people might tend to expect just in some of the experiences that they've had drinking beer that they've imported out of Germany that's been maybe on the water for a little too long. It's not quite as fresh as it could be, or even maybe trying some craft beer styles that are brewed here in the States. But I had the experience, as I mentioned, working in a German brewery in Munich for a period of time that was, set a deep impression in my memory as far as the way that a beer as fresh as could possibly be, whether it be bottled or coming from the kegs that we sometimes had the opportunity to sample from, that it set into my mind this desire to try to find that taste profile. And I feel like this blend of a Pilsner grain bill tied in with a Vienna malt to add a little bit more bready characteristic to it is on the right path to achieving that. And so I keep dabbling in different recipe profiles. And so my more recent recipes, what I've tried are different variations of trying to find that. And so most recently I made some the batches where I did 80% Pilsner malt against 20% Vienna malt. Mm-hmm. I did a 73-27% blend, again with 27% being Vienna malt, and then 64%-36%. I'm still a little bit up in the air on where I'm landing as it pertains to that, but again, understanding that the ability to convert those grains, the full conversion capabilities of both the Pilsner malt as well as the Vienna malt is intended to deepen the complexity of the Helles from a grain perspective, while keeping it sort of on that sort of malty sweet profile that we're sort of shooting for as it pertains to that style.
And what about the rest of the bill? Are you still using the traditional German hops and same type of yeast?
Again, I'm going to be honest and just say that being the purist that I am and the fact that I grow the Hallertauer on the side of the house here, I will use Hallertauer hops and the Helles as a bittering hop. Mm-hmm. But the style does allow for a little bit of hop flavor and aroma. And in fact, that's one of the characteristics from my time working in the brewery in Munich that I remember so distinctly well, opening fresh bottles of the Helles that was brewed there, and working with the brewers, they pop it open and they always let the beers warm a little bit too, right? It was never like you took it where it was ice cold or even near 35 degrees or whatever. It'd be soak it in a bottle of warm water for a period of time if you needed to, in order to let that sort of fresh malty as well as hop characteristics open up. And when you pop it open, mm-hmm. Just kind of waft it under your nose, that hint of hops on the tail end of that aroma was just there as kind of like a little hint of what was to come. And it was like this really magical moment that's stuck in my memory and that I'm trying hard to replicate. And so when I'm brewing the Helles, that's where I use my homegrown leaf hops is on the tail end of the boil. Like typically what I'll do is as I mentioned before with the Oktoberfest and creating the whirlpool, during that whirlpool process, I will actually shut down the chilling for just a little bit of time or try to hit it right around 170 degrees Fahrenheit. It seems to be a good temperature to extract the aromatic components and some of the flavor components of the hops over about a 10 minute period of time. And then I will crank up the chilling process again. And typically I'm using like one of those muslin bags with the hops inside of it. Otherwise it gums everything up. So, kind of keep it in there, mix it around a little bit as needed. But really that's where I'm trying to find the tail end of a little bit of hop characteristic to bring that little extra special something to my Helles style.
And so do you think, do you use the same yeast and finishing techniques you did for the Munich Oktoberfest beer?
The yeast that I have used for the Helles are both imperial style yeasts. Mm-hmm. I've tried both the L13, the imperial global, as well as the L17, the imperial harvest. The harvest supposedly comes from the Augustina brewery. The global, as I mentioned before, supposedly the Weihenstephan. I'm a little up in the air on both of them. I'm going to actually do a side-by-side brew here one of these days and, mm-hmm. and use the yeast in both of those with probably the same grain bill. Everything is close to being the same as possible and try to come to a better conclusion as to which I like better for my Helles yeast. The one thing that I would say, Noah, we're going to jump off here to another topic in a second, is that as it pertains to a Helles, more important than anything is a aggressive boil. You got to boil it away. You got to boil the DMS away. So boil fast, again, even more so than I would say than the Oktoberfest. Boil hard and then chill fast. And that'll help reduce some of the potential off flavors that could come with a beer of such light quality.
Yeah, I mean, being a light lager, almost any flaw is going to show up pretty big in these beers. So obviously, you got to be really careful all the way through the process, right?
That, absolutely. And I'll tell you, in my opinion, there's no better sign of brewing ability than to be able to brew a light lager well. So I consider it a challenge that I'm always willing to face, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, we're coming up near the end of the time. I wanted to give you a couple minutes to talk about your fiction book, An Oktoberfest Death, that you published just a short time ago. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Sure. So, An Oktoberfest Death, it's my first run at fiction, published at the end of September, early October. It is intended to be the first book in a series that follows the adventures of my main character. Her name is Bethany R. Judge, to be specific. She's a retired police officer, and she decides to become a beer expert, a certified master cicerone, and start like on her first big adventure, so to speak, to travel over to Munich and learn firsthand about Bavarian beers, specifically the Oktoberfest. But she drinks plenty of Helles, Hefeweizen, and Dunkles along the way. You know, and of course, then she finds herself in a bunch of different situations where murder is involved, and she tries to get herself out of a sticky situation. It gives me an opportunity writing that novel to really touch upon things that I've experienced in truly like experienced in my real life, and you can kind of pick up some of those things in the novel as you read it. There's a mention of being at the Oktoberfest, and there's an old gentleman with his lederhosen flap hanging open, and he's urinating in the middle of the crowd. Well, I saw that happen in real life.
Oh, I've seen that happen too there.
Yeah. I mean, it's like some of the funny things that you get to experience, you know. And the book opens with Bethany using the train as a place to sleep, as opposed to getting a hotel, and a little bit of taking liberties on that one, but I did the same thing when I lived in Salzburg, and to travel back to Salzburg instead of getting a hotel in Munich, I took the train from Munich back to Salzburg and just slept it off during that trip. And a whole lot of, you know, other little pieces like that that are tied into the story that are based upon experience. And then culture and history, you know, that get really like wrapped into what I hope the reader will find to be an exciting story. People may not know that the original sort of rise of the Nazi Party in Germany started sort of semi-officially in 1923 when Adolf Hitler tried to overthrow the Bavarian government. That was called the Beer Hall Putsch. It was a coup d'etat effort.
I recall reading about it in history, yeah.
Yeah, so it ultimately failed. And there's a brief comment, sort of like a there's a part to the story where there's a letter that's being read that sort of ties back to that beer hall putsch, right? So, So all the experiences, all the sort of knowledge and things that I kind of picked up along the way that are kind of tied in a variety of different ways throughout the story. And then, you know, what will ultimately happen then is, you know, I'm working on the second book in the series. And it really, as the series continues, the arc brings us from Munich to the United States. And what's going to happen now will all take place within the American craft brewing world.
Cool. Well, Thomas, where can people find the book?
So it's published under my full pen name, which is Thomas J. Miller. J as in John. So Thomas J. Miller. It's available on my author website, which is thomasjmillerauthor.com. If you order from my website, I will sign that copy and send it out to you. If you're interested in ordering from other online platforms, it's certainly available on Amazon, and it's available on Barnes and Noble. It can be ordered on Amazon also on as a Kindle version as well. So there are electronic versions out there. If there's anybody listening who's a librarian or works in a bookstore, it is also available on the major wholesaler websites like Baker and Taylor and Ingram. Mm-hmm. And again, it's published under the title An Oktoberfest Death. And Oktoberfest is spelled O-K-T-O-B-E-R, Fest, all one word, under my name, Thomas J. Miller.
Well, Thomas, thank you very, very much for coming on the show. It's been great having you.
I really appreciate it. It was a lot of fun. Hope to do it again.
And my guest today was Thomas Miller. Thomas has written a number of articles on brewing and the craft beer industry, and he recently published his first novel, On Oktoberfest Death. Thanks again, Thomas.
Thank you.
A big thank you to Thomas Miller for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're offering access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com to get your subscription today. And also the Brew Commander, the new brewhouse controller from Blickman Engineering. It's available in electric and gas propane models. The patent-pending Brew Commander is a high-quality brewhouse controller that offers automated step mashing, boil timers, precision temperature control, and advanced settings. Command your brew day with the new Brew Commander. To order yours today, go to BlickmanEngineering.com. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I urge you to give Beersmith Brewing Software a try. If you've not downloaded the new 3.1 update, grab it now, as it includes improved data storage, additional dry hop options, new mash pH models, new add-ons, and much more. To download a free 21-day trial, go to beersmith.com today. Again, that's beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.